Dear professors, dear students, thank you for inviting me to give this talk here at Moscow State University. It is a great honor for me to be here. So it's actually my first time in Moscow. And all I want to do in the next hour or so is tell you a little bit about how I think, from my perspective, how we have changed from business, where the world circles around companies like Amazon.com, to me business, where we want the world to circle around individuals. Very briefly, in terms of my background, as you see, I'm running a company now called People and Data. So I've always been very, very interested in people and data. In the 80s, when I was an undergraduate student, I worked at CERN in Geneva. And at that stage, that was the exciting place to work with data, less so with people, although we all know that the World Wide Web emerged from CERN in the early 90s. In the 90s then, I became an assistant professor of computer science. I was asked the question, I was thinking, what do I do with the grant I got from the National Science Foundation? Shall I buy a Sun workstation where memory alone cost us $30,000? I think it was like 100 megabyte or something like this of RAM. Or should we hire Thrust just to do the work for us? At that stage, I decided that I was going to actually buy the memory. Maybe I would have been better had I got it. In the 90s then, people and data meant for me to do work in computer science and machine learning, as well as consult street. So one of the interesting projects I had was that I had a database of 30 million transactions of so-called T-bond futures trades, including the identity of the trader. And you can see that in that, which was 3 years of every single transaction in Chicago, that on a day set like that, you can do very interesting things. And what we did, we used so-called hidden Markov models to understand what the different states were those traders were in. Then in the late 90s, I started a company called Mood Logic. And Mood Logic was what, can you guess, about people and data. In this case, it was a company where we tried to collect music metadata with the data about songs which people provided us with. After a few years, we had 1 billion, 10 to the 9, explicit pieces of information about many hundreds of thousands of songs. Probably the best music database ever created. And this company was subsequently sold to a company called All Media Guide. I then went to Amazon, which most of you know, as one of the largest laboratories to do experiments on people and data. Namely, about 1 million, or sometimes even more, of people coming every day, and they're like guinea pigs, that you can show them different things and they react, and that's where the physics, the experimental physics in me comes through, namely that you want to set up the right experiments in order to find out as we can do about what people do. So we'll see that one level, which I'm going to talk about in this talk today, is about creating architectures of experimentation. We'll after that move to architectures of partisan. How do we not only get these people to be guinea pigs who show us with the implicit things what they do, but how do we get them to tell us explicit things, additional things which we didn't expect? And then the last level, or the third level, is how to get from having all of these participations, and you might know about MySpace with more than 100 million people, how do we get these in the sky to connect? How can we connect the dots? How we can create architectures of interaction? For me, it's a journey of from e-business to me business I want to take you to. Let's, before we do that, take a look back of what happened the last 20 years since Perestroika here. In 1986, probably after the building was built, about 20 years ago, we did have email. Actually, in those days when I was at CERN, I was talking to people in staff, and we already were using email in those days. In the e-business setting, nobody used the term e-business then, but the setting, there were some people who used broadcast emails and sent out newsletters through email. It was about targeting people. So it was a very military metaphor. You target somebody and then you shoot at them. Now, that has moved in the last 10 years, say 1996, to become much more of a search. I mean, oh no, I search, therefore I am. Descartes or someone like that said this. And that means that in search, your most intimate thought you have and are conveying to the computer or to your search engine. Enigma being an example of a search engine was in the middle here. Now, however, in 2006, we are not only talking about search, but we are talking about this. Like Victor is just discovering something on his little device there. Some message came in, and now I'm competing in this attention economy against attention, which is drawn to him by this box. And by the way, attention and information flow in opposite ways. So maybe now I manage to read attention here. I'll tell you in a moment what I mean by intention economy and attention economy. We'll talk about that in a moment. So, 10 years ago, 1996, we created a web which was the read-only web. Companies were able to put links on their pages. Some professors like us had links those days, but the citizens, all they could do was click on a link. They would follow where those in power wanted to take them. It was a static web. It was a web which had controlled taxonomy. It was that in Germany, for instance, the Duden-Redaktion decides on how words should be spelled, or Académie Française in France. And it was a world where we pre-tested and validated, where we really worried to everything or anything if we weren't really sure that it wouldn't crash. A paradigm which came from shrink wrap software, like say, where you try your best and then you ship it and you pray that it won't break. Now, 2006, in contrast, is no longer the read-only web, but it's a read-write web. So we don't talk just about consumers, but because also can write, we talk about a mix of producers and consumers, which we sometimes call prosumers. And business models 10 years ago were characterized by an as high as possible barrier of exit. Once a company like AOL has, they will do everything to make it hard for that person to unsubscribe. You get put into phone lines and wait and wait and wait. As explained this morning, waiter means not he waits on you, but you wait for him. So I think you are used to that. However, now we live in a world of a low barrier of entry. No longer the high barrier of exit, but the low barrier of exit. So that means you want to make it as trivially easy for people as possible for them to play with you. For instance, who of you actually has a MySpace account? Nobody. Amazing. So, usually when I ask about dating, who of you goes to a dating site? Nobody raises their hand. And then I say, think about your best friend. Okay? Who of your friend goes to a dating site? Everybody's hand raised. But if MySpace is not popular here, then I guess the question even, won't work if I ask who of your best friends is this. So MySpace is an example of 100 or more millions Americans, mainly Europeans, who actually have their pages. Well, you need it.
It's a live journal, I think.
Live journal. Good example. It's more like a blog, and live journal is less about connecting the dots like MySpace, but it's more about an architecture of participation, of just reproducing yourself. So it's more like you express yourself as opposed to you hit on others who are practicing themselves. Live journal is a good example of where you are a producer. And I presume that the barrier of entry into live journal is also very low. You have to take like 5 courses in parallel computing until you can make an account in live journal. Maybe only 1 course. Big difference. Live journal, as a good example, which I'm playing with right now, is actually very temporal. It matters that people who they had dinner with last night, which probably was a different person from the night before last, which was a different person. Whereas the web was not really temporal. So the ordering parameter, to use this term for physics, instead of space, has become time. And search engines which are good in the spatial domain, such as Google with a PageRank algorithm, are actually being replaced by other machines, such as Technorati, which emphasize the temporal domain. Very smart, as you probably know from LiveJournal, how they can claim your blog. You claim your blog by putting in a little code which they give you in your email on blog, and so they know that you are the guy who actually has access to the email, and so you can claim and say, this is my blog. Temporary domain, so update it at technoradio.com when you made a new blog entry. Different paragraph. And finally, very important point, instead of pre-test and validate your entry, you launch and learn. You publish it, and you see what other people are saying. You open up the world for community, for contacts, for comments on what you have written. In the more business world, we say that this means permanent. So it used to be an excuse for not, you know, debugging your code, but for having others debug your code. But nowadays, it's sort of something you have to say. You have to say, you used to say copyright, now you say permanent beta stamp. And finally, instead of having a taxonomy controlled, which means, excuse me, which out of the following 7,343 things apply to your profession? But looks a list that long through. You just say, hey, here are some tags, some little etiquettes, some little labels, which I put on. Very different world. 1996, post Netscape IPO already. 2006, the last 20-something days left for Theo. Finally, discovery being here at my heart, because me business uncover things. It doesn't want to have targeted, pushed things at them. Means here that 10 years ago, discovery was based on the hyperlinks, those put in the pages. Now, discovery is based on very different things. That's what I want to explore in this talk. It's based on social. Who do you trust? Trust being a bi-directional relationship. Who has a good reputation? Reputation being a property of the person. As well as metadata, which are often created by other people. You know, you should computers have do what computers are, and you should have people do what people are good at. Mixing those things tend to not work very well. Finally, we have a new paradigm being established here, which is about the consumption of information. And now we are actually enabled to make clear distinction about the consumption of information. So, when Victor sends me an email at 5 o'clock on Friday morning saying, sorry, we didn't manage a business visa for you, but here are your options. You can fly to South America and try it, you know, or something like that. Then I better read this in real time. In contrast, when you post something on LiveJournal, and I might subscribe to your feed, to your RFS feed, you probably don't religiously read everything right on time. I mean, you might expect it, but your expectation might be not met by me. So it's very good. Different technologies now bear with them different ways of how communication is thought through. Email or short messaging as a one-on-one communication, email relatively asynchronous, short messaging resonance. In parallel to that, RSS feeds as something where you have lots and lots and lots of stuff the flood brings in. However, only few of them would be worth your reading, and that's where you need additional information. Additional information from what other people read, what in the past. So there are companies which do this, what's called attention stream mining, where you look at the attention stream, what do you look at, what do you make forward to your friend, what do you forward to your professor? What does your professor forward to you? And who you attend to in the past? Maybe if your professor reads something in the morning, you better read it as well. So that's what I mean by attention stream mining, and that's the basis of these additional data sources which allow us to actually have architectures of discovery. So in summary, it used to be that it was supply driven. There is stuff and you can do it. Same is true for clothes. Think about, you know, Soviet times, those of you who were around, that if something is in store, you better buy it, otherwise you probably have nothing to wear. On the other hand, now we live in a discovery world, in a demand-driven world. Companies like Adidas, the CEO of Adidas told me 2 months ago that only 8 hours after him making a phone call, the shops in Germany will be full of Adidas sweatshirt of exactly that country for the world he would have specified. 48 hours. That is very much demand-driven. Or Zara, Z-A-R-A, a high-end Spanish store. If Madonna, the singer, gives a concert in Barcelona, in the first row, you have all these fashion designers. Just careful looking at this. 10 days later, you can buy her dress in the stores of Zara. So we really moved into a demand-driven world. And those of you who know a little bit about the space Victor is in, how do these search engines get monetized? It used to be that people pay for the space. It's like the big bulletin boards you see when you come in from the airport, or it's like painting buses, or are there still newspapers around? Anybody seen anybody? Yeah? So in newspapers, you rent the space, you know, you rent the space, and the top right it says, you know, buy my car or stuff like that. Then we move to time where you pay for presentment. That means if I actually show an ad, then you pay me, whether the person sees it or not, whether the person acts upon the question. And now we pretty much moved into a time where you actually measure stuff. That's the exciting things for people like us who are numbers people. You can measure stuff where the person clicks on it. Only if somebody clicks, Victor has to be paid. So you can show it as often as you want. If the person doesn't click, get paid. Of course, Victor gets paid more per click than he would get paid by presenting it beforehand. And we push those risks for us down the strain even further and say, well, maybe you can click as often as you want, but only when you, for instance, sign up for a newsletter or when you actually buy something will you get paid by me. Are these models totally new? Of course not. Amazon, for instance, has a notion of affiliate. An affiliate is a person, I'm, for instance, an Amazon affiliate, that if you go to vegan.com, my homepage, and click on amazon.com, and then within 24 hours, I get 5 to 7% of what you bought into my account. So when you want to buy at Amazon, first go to vegan.com, click, and you know I get the money. In addition to that, I actually know what you bought. Okay, some examples. We talked about money economy, intention economy to attention economy. What do you mean by this? Money economy, about 10 interactions a day. For example, this wonderful caviar crepe before. That's an example of money exception, money economy. The woman, money, woman gives to me caviar, great. But you can't eat caviar more than 10 times a day, so order me 10 such exchanges per day. As a physicist, I do orders of magnitude, I don't do numbers. Next is, how many intentions do we have? About 100 a day. Excuse me, where's the bathroom? That's an example of an intention exchange. I want to know something, and done. But then we have the attention economy. That is another of order of magnitude more. You listen attentively here. You smiling at me here means that I have your attention. And I back have Victor's attention from before. I was competing with the phone. So now, attention economy, we can actually do with people a lot. Attention economy is worth much more than the intention economy. The intent is worth, well, Google's market capitalization of $150 billion is part of the intention economy, because Google only knows about the intention, and based on the intention, it shows something to people, namely sponsored links. So the attention economy, we just have to figure out how to do it right, will be, I think, a lot more than that, because we have an order of magnitude more interaction in the attention economy. I mentioned how we can use the attention stream to deal with the information overload. Atenza is an example of a company in the United States which does that quite well. It's an Outlook. You put it in your computer, and in this river of news, it just shows you those articles which it thinks, based on your past and your friend's past behavior and authorities' past behavior, attention behavior, it thinks shows you what you might want to read right now. And just as standing in the river usually happens, just flows by you and you'll never see it again. The other example here is that we sometimes call about a recommendation economy or a discovery economy. And an example here is Cleverset, which takes the same hidden Markov models, which we talked about when we talked about understanding trader styles, or the speech recognition, which allows for hidden states to the world of e-business. Namely, in this process of creating and making product space awareness, it tries to understand, are you very early in that process, just trying to learn about digital cameras? Or are you ready to make up your mind, you want that Canon EOS 5D, and you just want to have the price? So one thing building this model is that you understand how specific is the query the person enters. If he says digital camera, you just give it a very different page from if he says Canon EOS 5D. Next example in this space, before I give you a little bit more theory, is this shift from the old world paying a few experts to create content to just let it play. Sometimes we call it user-generated content. And if you think about YouTube, another popular site in the United States, which was Google a month ago for $1.65 billion, it's mainly actually user-distributed and user-redistributed content. So how do we get to that data by the user. Well, there are two kinds of data. There are explicit data, what people give you, the video they upload, and there are implicit data, which they give you through the clicks. And we definitely do want to collect both the explicit and implicit data. Actually, 2 months ago, an exchange rate was set. Exchange rate between the attention economy and the money economy. It was by a company called Universal Music, who says, well, as you know, you can buy it as applies to countries where copyright is maybe regarded a little bit differently from Russia or from China. But to countries where you buy songs, you pay about $1 for a song.
On iTunes, for example,
right. And what Universal Music is launching this month, it says, instead of paying $1, you can listen to ads for 9 cents. So from this, you're all good mathematicians here. You know what the hourly rate is you can make by giving attention to something or by writing a program which pretends to be giving you attention to something.
$1 per 1.5 minutes of attention. Good rate.
Good.
It's like a well-known thing. In France, in order to call from a street phone, you need to listen to...
Absolutely. Or in Italy, you can have the chance of, when you call your home from, making free phone calls, and then you can, just as you are warming up, you know, the person you want to, you know, maybe have dinner with, you get that ad for, how about Domino's Pizza? This is how we move from algorithmic search to so-called social search. Algorithmic search means trying out from the link structure on the web, or from the temporal structure, or from the comment structure, or from the attention stream of people, what would be important. And that's very different from social search. Example one is Google Answers, MSN Answers, Yahoo Answers. Well, basically, you ask random people in the world random things, and guess what? They give you random answers. So that might not be the most exciting thing if you actually want to get to something where you care for the quality of the answer. So there's a lot of space here in this era of social search for reputation systems. People don't have to give their real name. Korea, for instance, when you sign up for Wi-Fi, for WLAN, you actually have to tell people what your passport number is. That's a dream, I would think. On the other hand, anonymous creation of accounts doesn't really bear much anymore. You could just have escaped prison 5 minutes ago and have, you know, no history when you start a new anonymous account. So pseudonyms is the word here. Pseudonym is a persistent use of a term. And I don't know, do you have a pseudonym online? On maybe Messenger, on IM?
Pseudonym. You mean nickname?
Nickname, exactly. I mean, you all looked at me as if I was talking about something you didn't know about. Nickname, that's the word here, right. So nickname, you might be known as whatever you're known for. And people know, this guy is smart. He always says the right things. You know, they don't know you in real world, but they know, well, if this guy speaks up, I better listen. So that is the idea here, that you want to have people who have a good reputation, and you want to build those reputations. These are super interesting algorithmic and game problems. How to build a reputation system. What are the desiderata? What are the desired properties of such a system? How can you make it tamper-proof? That you can't have all your friends vote for you and suddenly you're on top. So reputation systems for smart mathematicians is an interesting inventor. But here also we have computer scientists. So I want to show you about another example which uses computer science to deal with a problem going from algorithmic search to social search. And here's how it works. The other day, I was sitting at home and I got through a company called Illumio a question at my computer. A window popped up. Hello, do you know what SIP means? And I was really surprised. SIP means statistically improbable phrases. And it's something which we worked on at Amazon.com. So how come a guy who I don't know asked me, do you know what SIP means? So I decided to get to the bottom of that and found out where's the company. Turns out the company is in Palo Alto. Next day after school, I went there and said, hello, I want to know how Illumio works. And they said, well, we scan your entire hard drive. because presumably that is a good representation of that. I mean, for me at least it is. Not that I know everything from hard drive, but you know, some of the stuff actually I understand was from hard drive. Okay, interesting. And then every second there are dozens, maybe hundreds of questions in the universe people have. Most of them my isn't particularly competent about. But every now and then there's something which Illumio thinks by doing dot product essentially between the question, like information retrieval and what I have, you know, you are probably pretty good at answering the question. At least you're probably better than other people answering that question. So now it comes up, and it's of course not that my hard drive information goes somewhere else. You know, that was the KGB time. No, it's now in the times that my hard drive belongs to me, and nobody actually can get to this. Only the questions are going to come to my hard drive, and it only fits when it thinks that I'm interested in something. Okay. So now comes the question, do you know, does anybody know about SIPs? And I write back, yes. How much is it worth it for you? And by the way, here are my credentials, because I was Amazon staff. So, you know, probably I do know about it, whatever you want to know about it. And so that is interesting. It's another way of using information technology, of using technology and using data to filter that question who instead might have, that person might have accepted onto some mailing list. And thousands of people would have read the question and they would be pretty bored about it. But instead, it just finds out who is the person who knows probably. Let's send the question to that person. And if I had not answered, that person called John would have never known that I looked at the question. So a social negative feeling that, you know, I wrote to Andreas 3 times and he didn't respond. What's up with that? Discovery, in the world we know it, discovery usually of the head of the distribution moves to discovery in the tail of the distribution. And that means that discovery becomes social discovery. And I will give you 2 examples here. One is if tags, which you want to have in order to remember something you saw. You want to label URLs. And then to share those to the rest of the world. Then a virtuous cycle will start where you will see that, wow, these are all people who look at my tags. These are people who tag, for instance, my webpage. And then it gets exciting. Then you can see where else do they go? What other things do they discover? So we moved from a static model of discovery, such as Amazon.com has it, people who looked at X also looked at Y, where you need to just add a while and so on and so forth, where the person doesn't matter, to an individual model of discovery where you get the heels of that person who has maybe a little bit more time than you and looks around the universe, discovers interesting things, tags them, and then you profit from them happening here. And I want to show you an example of that. Another beautiful example of discovery is Flickr. Flickr is a photo sharing site with all this social engineering, all this incentive engineering, this attention engineering really well. So you can, for instance, add to someone a comment or a tag and you get the positive feedback, but you see that other people think your pictures are pretty cool and you can ultimately discover other people through both Delicious and through Flickr. Remember, architectures of participation and on top of that, architectures of interaction.
Something like site you like for scientific papers, you can do another site.
You can label sites you like, and you can share that with the rest of the world, and then you find people.
Can you see what sites, what are the other people who cited the paper?
The sites here, the citing, okay, sorry. Yes, sites here is an example, the scientific index, which also allows you to find out social structures. The big difference, however, is having written more than 100 papers, it's a lot of work to write a paper. So the barrier of entry is very high to get a paper written, let alone to have also the second order effect.
It's not about papers written, it's about papers read. So site-alike system, you search through some papers and you the papers you like, you store the site, well, the author, etc., on their in their system under your login, and you can see what other people have this paper and so on.
Got it. So in that case, actually, it's very very similar to the system.
Yes.
Yes. So the only difference is that here, Delicious is actually for ordinary people, whereas yours is just for scientists. just think about not only papers, but think about URLs, and I might as well show you a demo afterwards where I show you how easy it is. The hardest thing about Delicious is the spelling. del.icio.us belongs to Yahoo, right? By Yahoo 1 year ago. And so was Flickr, actually. LibreFlickr also belongs to Yahoo. Final point here before we get to more is localization is playing an important role. So there are companies which allow for tagging not only on URLs, but which bridge the physical world and the digital world, but allowing you to tag, for instance, your favorite or the McDonald's down the road, or the wonderful place where we had the caviar rolled into, what do you call it? Blini. Okay.
He tells the students do not eat this. Why? Дорого.